For some reason, I'm really nervous about making and posting this particular podcast. It feels weird to talk so much about how my personal art has come together and about how San Francisco drew it out of me. It feels like I'm oversharing, like I'm really exposed. This is out of character for me because I'm an Aquarius sun and a Leo rising. I generally have no problem, whatever, awkwardly oversharing on the internet or anywhere else. But this is new for me. I'm really plunging into the depths of a vast part of me that I don't typically share. I'm also claiming my own space as an artist. This podcast is for all those hidden artists out there. I see you, especially the ones working in tech. Now let's get on with the show. Today, we're going to start with a couple of life updates. Number one, I have a new puppy. Last fall, right before Thanksgiving, like a week before the holiday, I had to euthanize my amazing rescue dog, Stacy. Stacy taught me about unconditional love. She went through life like a boss, and we found this deep tenderness together. It still makes me cry as it was right before the holidays. Poor Stacy had a huge cancerous mass in the center of her body. She had barely any white blood cells left by the time I found out what was going on. And she was just obviously not doing well. So I fed her a bunch of snotty tissues, her favorite snack, and said goodbye. People who have been through the passing of a beloved dog know how this goes. A hole is left in your heart and in your house. The smell of home is not the same. The routine of going to bed and waking up is not the same. It was so hard. I was a dog mom without a dog, which just doesn't work for me. So I started looking around for what I wanted my next dog to be. I've always had rescues, but this time I wanted to select a breed that would fit with my lifestyle. I can't stress enough that no matter what kind of dog you get, rescue, purebred, puppy, or senior, always, always think about what will really fit in with your lifestyle. I wanted a dog who could go on a big hike or a backpack with my partner, but also a dog who would fit in with an apartment lifestyle, which gives us some size constraints. I also wanted someone who likes to snuggle. Stacy taught me that. We looked at all different kind of dog breeds, and we ended up with a standard poodle who at the time looked a lot like Stacy. If you want to see photos, you can go to my Instagram. Zed is now 6 months old, and he's just so adorable and sweet. Poodles are smart, and they require some training, but I actually love training as a way to bond with a dog with positive reinforcement. So everything I was planning here on the podcast is a bit delayed. Puppies, they grow up so fast, and I'm taking the time to make sure Zed has everything he needs, like snuggles and playtime and treats and lots of walks. Life update number two. I'm shutting down my current AppearWorks business. For a long time, this has included a Patreon and an online shop. Both of those things are closing as I reimagine what I'm doing and how my brand fits with who I am today. The name AppearWorks doesn't exactly scream calligraphy and illumination. Initially, it was started as a tech event company. I was organizing conferences and events for connecting tech to art. This was for burned out tech workers, including myself. During COVID, this changed to online events, and I was still feeling out the connection, searching for my place in tech as an art person. Then I realized that I could just do art if I wanted. Then I discovered calligraphy in the middle of the pandemic and realized that this is part of who I am, a calligrapher. It turns out I like drawing words in addition to writing them. I tried pivoting AppearWorks to calligraphy in an attempt to exit tech, but what I didn't plan on, what I couldn't foresee, was moving across the country from San Francisco to Vermont. Vermont, especially Burlington, is a very artsy place. There is a lot of support here for artists and craftspeople if they have a Vermont business. And that was the nail in the coffin for AppearWorks. And it's taken me a couple of years to come to terms with it. This podcast is still going. Make It Appear will stay the same as I go deep into figuring out what my next company and brand is about. And when I think about my experience in San Francisco, I can see how this happened. The rich culture and history in San Francisco fed my soul like a nutritious, artsy broth. The museums, the murals, the DIY culture, and the daily views that I had walking around such a beautiful city gradually awoke my inner artist and made it safe for her to finally come out and play. Street art and murals in San Francisco are in all kinds of unexpected places. It's a city that has embraced murals for a very long time. In 1930, In 1940, Diego Rivera, a famous surrealist painter and partner of Frida Kahlo, came to San Francisco from Mexico and graced the city with three murals. As a surrealist, Rivera looked to dreams and the subconscious for inspiration. In real life, he was a socialist, which is part of the symbolism in his paintings. The murals he left behind inspired local painters, which you'll hear about in a minute. And yes, we are now into the part of the podcast about art in San Francisco. The city has amazing street art everywhere you turn. The murals in San Francisco are not just there to be pretty. In many cases, they document a history that you won't see anywhere else. In the Mission and elsewhere, murals show the experience of Black, Indigenous, and Latinx people who we all know haven't exactly had their say in the history books. These murals surrounded me like talismans of survival and self-protection, which I really needed at the time. So let's do a bit of a tour. We're going to start with not a mural, but a fresco. It's a surprising artwork in an unexpected place called Coit Tower. Every city has its phallus. In San Francisco, Coit Tower is one of the first. It rises up on top of Telegraph Hill and is a visible landmark. Its lobby is covered with murals and frescoes painted after Diego Rivera's visit. Rivera was known to be empathetic towards socialism, And the artists at Koi Tower, tasked with painting murals by the Public Works Administration at the height of the Great Depression, they took that theme and they ran with it. It's a very interesting story, and there are some links in the show notes describing more of exactly what happened. Visiting Koi Tower, I had no idea about this history, but if you take a good look, you can see the depth of what is happening, which is very important because in 2015-ish, San Francisco tech workers were starting to wake up to the unbounded exploitation perpetuated in their workplaces, big and small. And this included me. In fact, at the Node conference in Oakland, can't remember which year, don't feel like looking it up, I watched a brilliant talk by Kelsey Gilmore Ennis about the 1934 Longshoremen's Uprising. I'm not going to go into an entire history lesson about workers' rights and what happened on this occasion, but these were some very intense protests and very intense times in San Francisco. And the energy of these protests endures within the city itself. The frescoes at Koi Tower are still crackling with this energy. You can just feel it when you look at them. It infused this awakening we had in tech in the 2010s after a bunch of us had suffered enough at our tech jobs and were starting to get together and talk about it. Although I only toured Koi Tower the one time, I lived in a neighborhood very close to the mission, which is full of street murals. I was walking past all of this on a daily basis, and many times I would just stop and drink it all in. In addition, I was always visiting museums. I saw Elizabeth Taylor's jewelry, and I saw Keith Haring's vivid paintings. I got to see one of my great fashion inspirations, Andre Leon Talley, talk about this Oscar de la Renta exhibit he curated. It was just amazing. I always had a membership to the De Young and the Legion of Honor. Other museums and spaces that inspired me were the Japanese Garden, Japantown itself with its super cool aesthetic, and the beautiful open space in the lobby of the LinkedIn building before Microsoft plastered the huge windows with the tackiest advertisements I have ever seen. Hopefully they've taken them down, but who knows? These were the places where I would go to recover myself when work was too much. I remember walking through a huge exhibit of David Hockney's work at the De Young Museum at a particularly desperate time. Visiting San Francisco's museums was my way of rediscovering who I was and finding life outside of tech. In the case of the David Hockney exhibit, I was surrounded by these vivid colors that the artist is known for. Some of the works were so large that they must have been the size of a tennis court, if you can imagine one hanging on a wall. What's wild is that Hockney created some of these paintings on an iPad. I guess those are drawings. A few years later, I bought a used copy of the monograph from the exhibition. Pro tip, if you want to buy one of these at an exhibit, but they're really pricey, check back in a few years. It might be half price like this one was. In the first days of the pandemic, I photocopied some of these paintings from this monograph and taped them above my desk. I would just get lost in this colorful forest during lockdown. And I still have this tape to my fridge. Aside from the many exhibits I saw at the De Young, I also loved visiting the Asian Art Museum. I spent so much time sketching the different pieces in that museum, one of my favorite things to do is to visit a museum by myself so that I can pick a piece in the museum and spend time sketching it. This helps me really get into the details of any work of art and see the detail of a face or what type of brushstrokes the artist was using. Visiting all of these museums and wandering the streets inspired me to bring more art into my own life. At the time, I was way too focused on work and career, trying to make it all better. This didn't leave much time in my day for art until I found a hack. During this time period, the mid-2010s, Mike Rode came out with his highly successful book about sketchnoting. Sketchnoting is the practice of making visual notes out of a presentation, a film, a book, or anything that you want to remember and maybe share later. Mike Rode's success had a lot to do with the fact that he had amassed a giant following on social media. In the mid-2010s, I'm talking 2011, 2012, social media was all about images and hashtags. This was the beginning of Instagram. His particular hashtag, SketchNoteArmy, pulled people together from many disciplines around this sketchnoting. As someone who enjoyed going to tech conferences, I saw this as an opportunity to finally bring together art and tech in a fresh and improvisational way. My first sketch note wasn't a tech talk at all, but it was a movie, Thelma and Louise. At this point, I no longer had a stash of art supplies, having moved from Atlanta, Georgia in the US to Sydney, Australia, and then to Mountain View, California, and then up to San Francisco in the space of a couple of years. My only supplies were one sketchbook and a handful of markers. I suspect I bought a set of Crayola markers at the drugstore. I still love this work of mine because it shows how my brain is wired, and that is to translate and synthesize what I see in different creative ways. So during this period, it would be a while before I attended another tech conference, but when I did, I took some colored pencils with me. I was at the 2012 Cascadia JS conference in Vancouver, Canada. I think I understood half of what I heard in the talks. You know how it goes. You rock up to this tech conference and it's just, you know, there's so much breadth to tech, even within a subject. You're not going to understand everything. But I kept sketching and it helped. It helped me remember what I did understand, and it gave me a marker for the things I didn't quite get, but I wanted to understand. Sketchnoting became a major theme during the last stages of my career in tech. In fact, I organized a conference and a community around it. It meant that much to me, and I discovered a lot about how the brain works and why drawing is important. But that's not what this episode is about. However, if you want to check out sketchnoting, I highly recommend Ashton Rodenheiser's Sketchnote School. You can look for her on Instagram. I think it's just Sketchnote School. She's doing some really cool things, and I love the community she's building. It's amazing. I worked so hard at combining art and tech with sketchnoting, partially because I thought I had to. In the midst of all the work I was trying to do to merge tech and the arts together, I realized that I could maybe just ditch the tech bits and be an artist. It was okay to open the door to that part of myself I tried to keep hidden for so long. I gave tech so many years of my life. I worked long hours. I endured so much that was horrible, traumatic, and unfair in the name of making a dollar. And like, I really want to thank the queer and trans community of San Francisco for modeling what it looks like to do this kind of deep digging and to surrender to just being yourself, whoever, whatever form that takes. These communities are so beautiful and vibrant in San Francisco. They encourage realness, however messy and different. And this is where I found the permission to finally just be myself. Borrowing some of this spirit helped me dig into my depths and recognize what's there. It's also a very San Francisco thing to do this kind of self-analysis. That's just what we do. In this spirit, I decided to just do some art. I went to the store and I stocked up. Paper, pastels, the good ones, sennelier, markers, pencils. I didn't know where I was going with this, so I just bought one of everything. I guess that's one of the good things about the tech paycheck, is you can literally go into an art store and come out with one of every color, pencil, marker, whatever that they have. That's what I did. As I mentioned, I was always sketching art and sculpture whenever I visited a museum. Sometimes on the weekends, I would get up in the morning and have breakfast at the outdoor sculpture garden at the De Young Museum, which was where their cafe was. Or I would go to the Japanese garden, which also had a little cafe, and I would draw the surroundings. I even took a weekend class in how to sketch birds out at Point Reyes amongst the tall trees and rugged coastline of Northern California. In this experimental phase, I was trying lots of different things and searching for my own artistic voice. Finding your way to your own aesthetic is so important and vital for artists. It's like finding your voice and learning how to say something with it. This reminds me of vocalists learning how to use their voice for music. Nobody controls the voice that they're born with. As an artist, there are certain things that appeal to you, that you want to work with, and then there is the areas where your talent shines. As a vocalist, you might want to be a heavy metal singer, but what happens if your singing voice sounds like Britney Spears or Dolly Parton? Although it might be interesting to hear a metal record by Dolly Parton, I would listen to that. This is where things get interesting, because someone who's dedicated will find a way to work with what they have to tell their story, to sing a song that says what they want it to say, in a style that is their own and playing to the strengths of their own voice. My own personal style has evolved in a direction that is completely opposite of tech. There is nothing about my personal style that is futuristic at all. For some reason, my artistic style has been for many years stuck in the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance. To give you an idea of how long I've known this, my journey started in 2006. I was still working at Equifax, deep in the belly of the corporate beast. Oh, I hated it. I had no idea I would ever live in California. I was deeply unhappy with so many aspects of my life. Where I lived, my job, working under corporate overlords, just being and existing in the South, and the seemingly endless racism and misogyny I saw and hated on an everyday basis. I was frustrated. There was just no end in sight. I got what my parents always wanted for me, and I was miserable. I'm guessing there's someone listening to this who is having similar feelings, and to that person, I want to say there is a way out. It might not be easy, it might take time, but there is a way. Just hang on, keep working at liberating yourself, even if the steps are small and they don't feel like much, and it doesn't make any sense to anyone but you. Keep trying. The place where this started for me still kind of baffles me. I have evidence of the whole thing because I still have my journals full of art and the practice I was doing. In 2006, I took an online class in Celtic knot work. For some reason, black graphic lines and art made with them resonates with me. It feels like what my hand wants to draw. This is what I remember drawing and loving as a child. Even when I would color, my hand was heavy and I filled the coloring shapes with lines. This was also the time when, in 2006, when the first Lord of the Rings trilogy was being released in theaters. The magic of these movies was bookended by Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling at the time had not gone full bore on being such a TERF. And I think that all of this sort of got into my brain, and this kind of influenced my aesthetic. It came out of both of these film series and led me to something called Celtic knotwork. So this type of drawing is very technical, which appealed to me as someone working in tech. Like, graphic and technical things just appeal to me. There are several steps to follow to do this type of drawing, and a particular structure in order for a shape to appear that is made of one continuous line. I'll talk more about this type of art and my experience learning it in a following episode, perhaps, but for now, this was my entree into the world of illumination and manuscripts. In the many intervening years, I've also learned some calligraphy, lettering, and the process of making a piece illuminated, that is, highlighting a piece with gold. If all of this sounds a bit medieval, that's because it is. Despite the fact that I worked at the tip of the technology spear for many, many years, my artistic practice is squarely rooted in the distant past. But even though I lived in San Francisco at the height of the social media wave, it did end with a literal plague, which I think that's pretty medieval. As part of learning and researching illuminated manuscripts, something I've come to appreciate about the art in illuminated manuscripts is how the monks creating it included plenty of tiny little absurdities. A hat with a candle hanging from it. Paw marks from someone's cat walking across the page. Penises and vaginas. Yes, yes. Many penises and many vaginas. In a weird way, it does fit because life in San Francisco during the tweens of the 21st century was nothing if not completely, fantastically absurd. It was absurd, like seeing a coworker's side project on the national news, or watching a room full of writers absolutely melting down because the printed book is supposedly dying. It was seeing the scooters that were indiscriminately dropped all over the city gathered up to block one of the many tech buses. There were several television series that tried to capture this madness, but I promise you, real life was much, much stranger. And it hasn't stopped either. There are now self-driving cars all over the city causing chaos in the streets. And I wish I was making this up. I need to thank San Francisco because I don't know if I would have found my way back to art without it. And it's been a blast kind of doing the self-reflection because I now finally feel like I'm where I want to be doing what I want to do. And I have San Francisco to thank for that. Thanks for watching. Bye for now.